Craig Toomey heard the brat begin to caterwaul back there someplace and ignored it. He had found what he was looking for in the third locker he opened, the one with the name Markey dymo-taped to the front. Mr. Markey's lunch. A sub-sandwich poking out of a brown paper bag was on the top shelf. Mr. Markey's street shoes were placed neatly side by side on the bottom shelf. Hanging in between from the same hook were a plain white shirt and a gun belt. Protruding from the holster was the butt of Mr. Markey's service revolver. Craig unsnapped the safety strap and took the gun out. He didn't know much about guns. This could have been a .32, a .38, or even a .45 for all of him. But he was not stupid, and after a few moments of fumbling, he was able to roll the cylinder. All six chambers were loaded. He pushed the cylinder back in, nodding slightly when he heard it click home, and then inspected the hammer area in both sides of the grip. He was looking for a safety catch, but there didn't appear to be one. He put his finger on the trigger and tightened until he saw both the hammer and the cylinder move slightly. Craig nodded, satisfied. He turned around and, without warning, the most intense loneliness of his adult life struck him. The gun seemed to take on weight, and the hand holding it sagged. Now he stood with his shoulders slumped, the briefcase dangling from his right hand, the security guard's pistol dangling from his left. On his face was an expression of utter, abject misery. And suddenly, a memory recurred to him, something he hadn't thought of in years. Craig Toomey, 12 years old, lying in bed and shivering as hot tears ran down his face. In the other room, the stereo was turned up loud, and his mother was singing along with Merrily Rush in her droning, off-key drunk's voice.
Just call me Angel of the Morning, baby. Just touch my cheek before you leave me, baby.
Lying there in bed, shaking, crying, not making a sound, and thinking, why can't you love me and leave me alone, Mama? Why can't you just love me and leave me alone? I don't want to hurt anyone, Craig Toomey muttered through his tears. I don't want to, but this is intolerable. Across the room was a bank of TV monitors, all blank. For a moment, as he looked at them, the truth of what had happened, what was still happening, tried to crowd in on him. For a moment, it almost broke through his complex system of neurotic shields and into the air raid shelter where he lived his life.
Everyone is gone, Craigy Wiggy. The whole world is gone except for you and the people who were on that plane.
No, he moaned, and collapsed into one of the chairs standing around the formica-topped kitchen table in the center of the room. No, that's not so. That's just not so. I refute that idea. I refute it utterly. The Langoliers were here, and they will be back, his father said. It overrode the voice of his mother, as it always had. You better be gone when they get here, or you know what will happen. He knew, all right. They would eat him. The Langoliers would eat him up. But I don't want to hurt anyone, he repeated in a dreary, distraught voice. There was a mimeographed duty roster lying on the table. Craig let go of his briefcase and laid the gun on the table beside him. Then he picked up the duty roster, looked at it for a moment with unseeing eyes, and began to tear a long strip from the left-hand side. Rip! Soon he was hypnotized, as a pile of thin strips, maybe the thinnest ever, began to flutter down onto the table. But even then, the cold voice of his father would not entirely leave him. Or you know what will happen. The frozen silence following Dinah's warning was finally broken by Robert Jenkins. We have some problems, he said in a dry lecture hall voice. If Dinah hears something, and following the remarkable demonstration she's just given us, I'm inclined to think she does. It would be helpful if we knew what it is. We don't. That's one problem. The plane's lack of fuel is another problem. There's a 727 out there, Nick said, all cozied up to a jetway. Can you fly one of those, Brian? Yes, Brian said. Nick spread his hands in Bob's direction and shrugged as if to say, there you are, one knot untied already. Assuming we do take off again, where should we go? Bob Jenkins went on. A third problem. Away, Dinah said immediately. Away from that sound. We have to get away from that sound and what's making it. How long do you think we have? Bob asked her gently. How long before it gets here, Dinah? Do you have any idea at all?
No, she said from the safe circle of Laurel's arms. I think it's still far. I think there's still time, but...
Then I suggest we do exactly as Mr. Warwick has suggested, Bob said. Let's step over to the restaurant, have a bite to eat, and discuss what happens next. Food does have a beneficial effect on what Monsieur Poirot liked to call the little gray cells.
We shouldn't wait, Dinah said fretfully.
15 minutes, Bob said. No more than that. And even at your age, Dinah, you should know that useful thinking must always precede useful action. Albert suddenly realized that the mystery writer had his own reasons for wanting to go to the restaurant. Mr. Jenkins's little gray cells were all in apple pie working order, or at least he believed they were, and following his eerily sharp assessment of their situation on board the plane, Albert was willing at least to give him the benefit of the doubt. He wants to show us something, or prove something to us, he thought. Surely we have 15 minutes, he coaxed.
Well, Dinah said unwillingly, I guess so.
Fine, Bob said briskly. It's decided. And he struck off across the room toward the restaurant, as if taking it for granted that the others would follow him. Brian and Nick looked at each other. We better go along, Albert said quietly. I think he knows stuff. What kind of stuff? Brian asked. I don't know exactly, but I think it might be stuff worth finding out. Albert followed Bob. Bethany followed Albert. The others fell in behind them, Laurel leading Dinah by the hand. The little girl was very pale. The Cloud Nine restaurant was really a cafeteria with a cold case full of drinks and sandwiches at the rear, and a stainless steel counter running beside a long, compartmentalized steam table. All the compartments were empty, all sparkling clean. There wasn't a speck of grease on the grill. Glasses, those tough cafeteria glasses with the ripply sides, were stacked in neat pyramids on rear shelves, along with a wide selection of even tougher cafeteria crockery. Robert Jenkins was standing by the cash register. As Albert and Bethany came in, he said, May I have another cigarette, Bethany?
Jay, you're a real mooch, she said,
but her tone was good-natured. She produced her box of Marlboros and shook one out. He took it, then touched her hand as she also produced her book of matches. I'll just use one of these, shall I? There was a bowl filled with paper matches advertising LaSalle Business School by the cash register. For our matchless friends, a little sign beside the bowl read. Bob took a book of these matches, opened it, and pulled one of the matches free.
Sure, Bethany said. But why?
That's what we're going to find out, he said. He glanced at the others. They were standing around in a semicircle, watching, all except Rudy Warwick, who had drifted to the rear of the serving area and was closely inspecting the contents of the cold case. Bob struck the match. It left a little smear of white stuff on the striker, but didn't light. He struck it again with the same result. On the third try, the paper match bent. Most of the flammable head was gone anyway. My, my, he said in an utterly unsurprised tone. I suppose they must be wet. Let's try a book from the bottom, shall we? They should be dry. He dug to the bottom of the bowl, spilling a number of matchbooks off the top and onto the counter as he did so. They all looked perfectly dry to Albert. Behind him, Nick and Brian exchanged another glance. Bob fished out another book of matches, pulled one, and tried to strike it. It didn't light. Son of a bee, he said. We seem to have discovered yet another problem. May I borrow your book of matches, Bethany? She handed it over without a word.
Wait a minute, Nick said slowly.
What do you know, matey?
Only that this situation has even wider implications than we at first thought, Bob said. His eyes were calm enough, but the face from which they looked was haggard. And I have an idea that we all may have made one big mistake. Understandable enough under the circumstances, but until we've rectified our thinking on this subject, I don't believe we can make any progress. An error of perspective, I'd call it.
Warwick was wandering back toward them. He had selected a wrapped sandwich and a bottle of beer.
His acquisition seemed to have cheered him considerably.
What's happening, folks?
I'll be damned if I know, Brian said, but I don't like it much. Bob Jenkins pulled one of the matches from Bethany's book and struck it. It lit on the first strike.
Ah,
he said, and applied the flame to the tip of his cigarette. The smoke smelled incredibly pungent, incredibly sweet to Brian, and a moment's reflection suggested a reason why. It was the only thing, save for the faint tang of Nick Hopewell's shaving lotion and Laurel's perfume, that he could smell. Now that he thought about it, Brian realized that he could hardly even smell his traveling companion's sweat. Bob still held the lit match in his hand. Now he bent back the top of the book he'd taken from the bowl, exposing all the matches, and touched the lit match to the heads of the others. For a long moment, nothing happened. The writer slipped the flame back and forth along the heads of the matches, but they didn't light. The others watched, fascinated. At last, there was a sickly fss sound, and a few of the matches erupted into dull, momentary life. They did not really burn at all. There was a weak glow, and they went out. A few tendrils of smoke drifted up, smoke which seemed to have no odor at all. Bob looked around at them and smiled grimly. Even that, he said, is more than I expected. All right, Brian said. Tell us about it. I know. At that moment, Rudy Warwick uttered a cry of disgust. Dinah gave a little shriek and pressed closer to Laurel. Albert felt his heart take a high skip in his chest. Rudy had unwrapped his sandwich. It looked to Brian like salami and cheese and had taken a large bite. Now he spat it out onto the floor with a grimace of disgust.
It's spoiled, Rudy cried. Oh, God damn. I hate that.
Spoiled? Bob Jenkins said swiftly. His eyes gleamed like blue electrical sparks. Oh, I doubt that. Processed meats are so loaded with preservatives these days that it takes 8 hours or more in the hot sun to send them over. And we know by the clocks that the power in that cold case went out less than 5 hours ago. Maybe not, Albert spoke up. You were the one who said it felt later than our wristwatches say.
Yes, but I don't think... Was the case still cold, Mr. Warwick? When you opened it, was the case still cold?
Not cold, exactly, but cool, Rudy said. That sandwich is all fucked up, though. Pardon me, ladies. Here,
he held it out.
If you don't think it's spoiled, you try it.
Bob stared at the sandwich, appeared to screw up his courage, and then did just that, taking a small bite from the untouched half. Albert saw an expression of disgust pass over his face, but he did not get rid of the food immediately. He chewed once, twice, then turned and spat into his hand. He stuffed the half-chewed bite of sandwich into the trash bin below the condiment shelf and dropped the rest of the sandwich in after it. Not spoiled, he said. Tasteless. And not just that, either. It seems to have no texture. His mouth drew down in an involuntary expression of disgust. We talk about things being bland. Unseasoned white rice, boiled potatoes, but even the blandest food has some taste, I think. That had none. It was like chewing paper. No wonder you thought it was spoiled.
It was spoiled, the bald man reiterated stubbornly.
Try your beer, Bob invited. That shouldn't be spoiled. The cap is still on, and a capped bottle of beer shouldn't spoil, even if it isn't refrigerated. Rudy looked thoughtfully at the bottle of Budweiser in his hand, then shook his head and held it out to Bob.
I don't want it anymore, he said.
He glanced at the cold case. His gaze was baleful, as if he suspected Jenkins of having played an unfunny practical joke on him.
I will if I have to, Bob said. But I've already offered my body up to science once. Will somebody else try this beer? I think it's very important.
Give it to me, Nick said.
No.
It was Don Gaffney.
Give it to me. I could use a beer, by God. I've drunk them warm before, and they don't cross my eyes none.
He took the beer, twisted off the cap, and upended it. A moment later, he whirled and sprayed the mouthful he had taken onto the floor.
Jesus, he cried. Flat. Flat as a pancake.
Is it? Bob asked brightly. Good. Great. Something we can all see.
He was around the counter in a flash, taking one of the glasses down from the shelf. Gaffney had set the bottle down beside the cash register, and Brian looked at it closely as Bob Jenkins picked it up. He could see no foam clinging to the inside of the bottleneck. It might as well be water in there, he thought. What Bob poured out didn't look like water, however. It looked like beer. Flat beer. There was no head. A few small bubbles clung to the inside of the glass, but none of them came pinging up through the liquid to the surface. All right, Nick said slowly. It's flat. Sometimes that happens. The cap doesn't get screwed on all the way at the factory, and the gas escapes. Everyone's gotten a flat lager from time to time. But when you add in the tasteless salami sandwich, it's suggestive, isn't it?
Suggestive of what? Brian exploded.
In a moment, Bob said. Let's take care of Mr. Hopewell's caveat first, shall we? He turned, grabbed glasses with both hands. A couple of others fell off the shelf and shattered on the floor. Then began to set them out along the counter with the agile speed of a bartender. Bring me some more beer, and a couple of soft drinks while you're at it. Albert and Bethany went down to the cold case and each took four or five bottles, picking at random.
Is he nuts? Bethany asked in a low voice.
I don't think so, Albert said. He had a vague idea of what the writer was trying to show them, and he didn't like the shape it made in his mind. Remember when he told you to save your matches? He knew something like this was going to happen. That's why he was so hot to get us to the restaurant. He wanted to show us. The duty roster was ripped into 36 narrow strips, and the Langoliers were closer now. Craig could feel their approach at the back of his mind. More weight. More insupportable weight. It was time to go. He picked up the gun in his briefcase, then stood up and left the security room. He walked slowly, rehearsing as he went.
I don't want to shoot you, but I will if I have to. Take me to Boston. I don't want to shoot you, but I will if I have to. Take me to Boston. I will if I have to, Craig muttered as he walked back into the waiting room. I will if I have to.
His finger found the hammer of the gun and cocked it back. Halfway across the room, his attention was once more snared by the pallid light which fell through the windows, and he turned in that direction. He could feel them out there, the Langoliers. They had eaten all the useless, lazy people, and now they were returning for him. He had to get to Boston. It was the only way he knew to save the rest of himself, because their death would be horrible. Their death would be horrible indeed. He walked slowly to the windows and looked out, ignoring, at least for the time being, the murmur of the other passengers behind him. Bob Jenkins poured a little from each bottle into its own glass. The contents of each was as flat as the first beer had been. Are you convinced? He asked Nick.
Yes, Nick said. If you know what's going on here, mate, spill it. Please, spill it.
I have an idea, Bob said. It's not, I'm afraid it's not very comforting, but I'm one of those people who believe that knowledge is always better, safer, in the long run than ignorance, no matter how dismayed one may feel when one first understands certain facts. Does that make any sense?
No,
Gaffney said at once. Bob shrugged and offered a small, wry smile. Be that as it may, I stand by my statement. And before I say anything else, I want to ask you all to look around this place and tell me what you see. They looked around, concentrating so fiercely on the little clusters of tables and chairs that no one noticed Craig Toomey standing on the far side of the waiting room, his back to them, gazing out at the tarmac. Nothing, Laurel said at last. I'm sorry, but I don't see anything. Your eyes must be sharper than mine, Mr. Jenkins.
Not a bit. I see what you see. Nothing. But airports are open 24 hours a day. When this event happened, it was probably at the dead low tide of its 24-hour cycle. But I find it difficult to believe there weren't at least a few people in here, drinking coffee and perhaps eating early breakfasts. Aircraft maintenance men, airport personnel, perhaps a handful of connecting passengers who elected to save money by spending the hours between midnight and 6 or 7 o'clock in the terminal instead of in a nearby motel. When I first got off that baggage conveyor and looked around, I felt utterly dislocated. Why? Because airports are never completely deserted.
just as police and fire stations are never completely deserted. Now, look around again and ask yourself this. Where are the half-eaten meals? The half-empty glasses? Remember the drinks trolley on the airplane with the dirty glasses on the lower shelf? Remember the half-eaten pastry and the half-drunk cup of coffee beside the pilot seat in the cockpit? There's nothing like that here. Where is the least sign that there were people here at all when this event occurred?
Albert looked around again and then said slowly, "There's no pipe on the foredeck, is there?" Bob looked at him closely. "What? What did you say, Albert?" "When we were on the plane," Albert said slowly, "I was thinking of this sailing ship I read about once. It was called the Mary Celeste, and someone spotted it just floating aimlessly along. Well, not really floating, I guess, because the book said the sails were set. But when the people who found it boarded her, everyone on the Mary Celeste was gone. The stuff was still there, though, and there was food cooking on the stove. Someone even found a pipe on the foredeck. It was still lit."
"Bravo!" Bob cried, almost feverishly. They were all looking at him now, and no one saw Craig Toomey walking slowly toward them. The gun he had found was no longer pointed at the floor.
"Bravo, Albert. You've put your finger on it. And there was another famous disappearance. An entire colony of settlers at a place called Roanoke Island, off the coast of North Carolina, I believe. All gone. But they had left remains of campfires, cluttered houses, and trash mittens behind. Now, Albert, take this a step further. How else does this terminal differ from our airplane?"
For a moment, Albert looked entirely blank, and then understanding dawned in his eyes.
"The rings!" he shouted. "The purses, the wallets, the money, the surgical pins. None of that stuff is here."
"Correct," Bob said softly. 100% correct. As you say, none of that stuff is here. But it was on the airplane when we survivors woke up, wasn't it? There were even a cup of coffee and a half-eaten Danish in the cockpit. The equivalent of a smoking pipe on the foredeck.
"You think we've flown into another dimension, don't you?" Albert said. His voice was awed. "Just like in a science fiction story."
Dinah's head cocked to one side, and for a moment she looked strikingly like Nipper, the dog on the old RCA Victor labels.
"No," Bob said. "I think..."
"Watch out!" Dinah cried sharply. "I hear some..."
She was too late. Once Craig Toomey broke the paralysis which had held him, and he started to move, he moved fast. Before Nick O'Brien could do more than begin to turn around, he had locked one forearm around Bethany's throat and was dragging her backward. He pointed the gun at her temple. The girl uttered a desperate, terrorized squawk.
"I don't want to shoot her, but I will if I have to," Craig panted. "Take me to Boston."
His eyes were no longer blank. They shot glances full of terrified, paranoid intelligence in every direction.
"Do you hear me? Take me to Boston."
Brian started toward him. Nick placed a hand against his chest without shifting his eyes away from Craig.
"Steady down, mate," he said in a low voice. "It wouldn't be safe. Our friend here is quite bonkers."
Bethany was squirming under Craig's restraining forearm.
"You're choking me. Please stop choking me."
"What's happening?" Dinah cried. "What is it?"
"Stop that," Craig shouted to Bethany. "Stop moving around. You're going to force me to do something I don't want to do."
He pressed the muzzle of the gun against the side of her head. She continued to struggle, and Albert suddenly realized she didn't know he had a gun, even with it pressed against her skull. She didn't know.
"Quit it, girl," Nick said sharply. "Quit fighting."
For the first time in his waking life, Albert found himself not just thinking like the Arizona Jew, but possibly called upon to act like that fabled character. Without taking his eyes off the lunatic in the crew neck jersey, he slowly began to raise his violin case. He switched his grip from the handle and settled both hands around the neck of the case. Toomey was not looking at him. His eyes were shuttling rapidly back and forth between Brian and Nick, and he had his hands full, quite literally, holding on to Bethany.
"I don't want to shoot her," Craig was beginning again. And then his arm slipped upward as the girl bucked against him, socking her behind into his crotch. Bethany immediately sank her teeth into his wrist.
"Ow!" Craig screamed. "Ow!"
His grip loosened. Bethany ducked under it. Albert leaped forward, raising the violin case as Toomey pointed the gun at Bethany. Toomey's face was screwed into a grimace of pain and anger.
"No, Albert!" Nick bawled. Craig Toomey saw Albert coming and shifted the muzzle toward him. For one moment, Albert looked straight into it, and it was like none of his dreams or fantasies. Looking into the muzzle was like looking into an open grave. I might have made a mistake here, he thought. And then Craig pulled the trigger. Instead of an explosion, there was a small pop, the sound of an old Daisy air rifle, no more. Albert felt something thump against the chest of his Hard Rock Cafe t-shirt. Had time to realize he had been shot. And then he brought the violin case down on Craig's head. There was a solid thud which ran all the way up his arms, and the indignant voice of his father suddenly spoke up in his mind. What's the matter with you, Albert? That's no way to treat an expensive musical instrument. There was a startled broink from inside the case as the violin jumped. One of the brass latches dug into Toomey's forehead, and blood splashed outward in an amazing spray. Then the man's knees came unhinged, and he went down in front of Albert like an express elevator. Albert saw his eyes roll up to whites, and then Craig Toomey was lying at his feet, unconscious. A crazy but somehow wonderful thought filled Albert's mind for a moment. By God, I never played better in my life. And then he realized that he was no longer able to get his breath. He turned to the others, the corners of his mouth turning up in a thin-lipped, slightly confused smile. I think I have been plugged, Ace Costner said. And then the world bleached out to shades of gray, and his own knees came unhinged. He crumpled to the floor on top of his violin case. He was out for less than 30 seconds. When he came around, Brian was slapping his cheeks lightly and looking anxious. Bethany was on her knees beside him, looking at Albert with shining, my hero eyes. Behind her, Dinah Bellman was still crying within the circle of Laurel's arms. Albert looked back at Bethany and felt his heart, apparently still whole, expand in his chest. The Arizona Jew rides again, he muttered. What, Albert? She asked and stroked his cheek. Her hand was wonderfully soft, wonderfully cool. Albert decided he was in love. Nothing, he said. And then the pilot whacked him across the face again. Are you all right, kid? Brian was asking. Are you all right? I think so, Albert said. Stop doing that, okay? And the name is Albert, Ace to my friends. How bad am I hit? I can't feel anything yet. Were you able to stop the bleeding? Nick Hopewell squatted beside Bethany. His face wore a bemused, unbelieving smile. I think you'll live, matey. I never saw anything like it in my life, and I've seen a lot. You Americans are too foolish not to love. Hold out your hand, and I'll give you a souvenir. Albert held out his hand, which shook uncontrollably with reaction, and Nick dropped something into it. Albert held it up to his eyes and saw it was a bullet. I picked it up off the floor, Nick said. Not even misshapen. He must have hit you square in the chest. There's a little powder mark on your shirt, and then bounced off. It was a misfire. God must like you, mate.
I was thinking of the matches, Albert said weakly. I sort of thought it wouldn't fire at all.
That was very brave and very foolish, my boy, Bob Jenkins said. His face was dead white, and he looked as if he might pass out himself in another few moments. Never believe a rider. Listen to them, by all means, but never believe them. My God, what if I'd been wrong? You almost were, Brian said. He helped Albert to his feet. It was like when you lit the other matches, the ones from the bowl. There was just enough pop to drive the bullet out of the muzzle. A little more pop, and Albert would have had a bullet in his lung.
Another wave of dizziness washed over Albert. He swayed on his feet, and Bethany immediately slipped an arm around his waist. I thought it was really brave, she said, looking up at him with eyes which suggested that she believed Albert Costner must shit diamonds from a platinum asshole. I mean, incredible.
Thanks, Ace said, smiling coolly, if a trifle woozily.
It wasn't much. The fastest Hebrew west of the Mississippi was aware that there was a great deal of girl pressed tightly against him, and that the girl smelled almost unbearably good. Suddenly, he felt good. In fact, he believed he had never felt better in his life. Then he remembered his violin, bent down and picked up the case. There was a deep dent in one side, and one of the catches had been sprung. There was blood and hair on it, and Albert felt his stomach turn over lazily. He opened the case and looked in. The instrument looked all right, and he let out a little sigh. Then he thought of Craig Toomey, and alarm replaced relief.
Say, I didn't kill that guy, did I? I hit him pretty hard.
He looked toward Craig, who was lying near the restaurant door with Don Gaffney kneeling beside him. Albert suddenly felt like passing out again. There was a great deal of blood on Craig's face and forehead.
"He's alive," Don said. "But he's out like a light."